Inside Lacrosse Podcast.
Thanks for coming back to the Inside Lacrosse MLL Podcast. I am joined, as always, by our man, Kyle Devitt, who has been watching all the games amid his transatlantic travels. We are 28% of the way through the MLL season. The league is taking a break this weekend to accommodate the NCAA Final Four, among other considerations, and then we'll dive back in the month of June in preparations leading up to the July unusual quadrennial World Championship break, with the FIL World Championships being in Denver. And so, Kyle, it's going to be a chaotic year. It has been to a degree already. We got a couple of guests lined up that can each speak to some of the early season storylines that we're going to be discussing here on the podcast. But to tee you up perfectly, I want you to start by telling listeners, particularly those who haven't been paying as close of attention to the MLL as they will here in the coming months, what is the biggest thing that they've missed so far?
Casey Powell lives. And it's amazing.
It's pretty remarkable. So for fans who haven't had an opportunity to see the launch play, and kind of see what type of player Casey is being, he, over the course of the last couple seasons in his spotted appearances in MLL games, had been playing primarily midfield. That is not the case with this team, correct?
He played the first couple games shifts at midfield. They still move him around, but he has gained the majority of his points playing attack and behind the net.
So for those that don't know, Casey Powell is currently leading the league in scoring. And Kyle, as you look at like sustainability, I talked to Casey a couple weeks ago, and he made the comment that it was nice to not have to travel for the first three games of the season. And certainly that's, you know, for a guy who is seasoned, experienced, and has a lot of miles on his body, that's a huge advantage. And certainly there's an early season element to it as well. What is your thought on, is this something that we should expect to see out of Casey Powell for the remainder of the 11 games that the Florida Launch will play this season?
I have learned in my many years covering the league that I should never doubt people like Casey Powell. It just, you don't doubt legends because it'll come back to get you. You know, I'm not in the business of prognosticating as much as maybe other people might want me to be or people think I am, but the one thing I've learned is that you don't bet against a guy that has a track record like Casey Powell. You just don't do it. It's not smart. It's not prudent. So I think, I don't know if he can sustain this clip the whole time, but I'm sure that he will remain a very active and dominant force on the Florida Launch.
He's got 11 goals and 12 assists for the Florida Launch team, a relocation of the Hamilton Nationals that then proceeded to lose two of their best players in Brody Merrill and Joe Walters. Joe Walters, who has not yet appeared in the league as a result of his Rochester Nighthawks advancing to the NLL Championship. But, I mean, just the Launch in general are an interesting story. Like, their second leading scorer is a tie between Garrett Thule, who has appeared in three games, Kieran McArdle, who has appeared in two, both have 8 points. Kevin Crowley has appeared in three games and has 6 points. And then I think it's also notable to comment that Brett Queener has a 61% save percentage, and he suffered a pretty serious hand injury in the first game. How remarkable is this start?
Well, if you watching the first half of the first game of the year that the Launch played against the Outlaws, they look like the worst team I've ever seen. That's not hyperbole. They were atrocious. The only reason Denver didn't drop 20 on them in the first half is Brett Queener. They looked terrible. Like, I couldn't even tell you. Like, I'm sitting back going, oh, I just did the preview. I'm like, oh, yeah, they're not going to be good. Yeah, I was right. And then second half comes and Denver kind of sleepwalks and Florida gets back in the game. And you're like, all right, well, at least they can score. So, you know, we're not going to go Ohio machine on them. You know, we're not going to write them off like we did Ohio the last 2 years. And then the next game comes and they're battling the whole time. And then they battle again. And then they beat the Bayhawks. And you're like, wait, what just happened? But what you see is that they have all these guys that freelance and they just didn't have a guy in charge in that first game. They just had like, you know, like Chaz Woodson and Vena Quattro just like taking runs, and they didn't have any like stationary shooters. They just had a bunch of guys that stood around and waited for the ball. What happened was in the preceding games from the first game, the advancing games, I should say, they started parceling out touches. like a little more organized. They looked much more cohesive as a unit. And I think, you know, that definitely helped them. I mean, they run cutters from the top instead of just dodging from the top and looking for a dump down. They dodge from the wing and look to the middle. They always look to the middle. That's one of the things that the Launch do better than probably any other team in the league right now. They look to the middle. Maybe Denver, I would say, probably does it better because they have Bocklet, but that's how they're winning. And their defense is actually playing much, much, much better than they did in week one as well.
I had an opportunity to go out to the one of the preseason scrimmage events in Anne Arundel County. It was, I believe, the Bayhawks were there, the Hounds were there, the Outlaws were there, and the Florida Launch were there. It was the first time, it was a week out of the start of the season, it was the first time that the Launch had ever been together as a team. So it's a little bit easy to understand why they looked so bad in their first game. How much credit do you give for their start to Stan Ross as a guy who has earned a fair amount of respect around the league for knowing what he's doing, knowing what he's talking about?
He's a defensive guy, and I think that, you know, he was probably very unhappy with the first game and went back, made some changes, moved some guys around. I still don't get – he has plenty of talent on the bench long pole-wise, and I don't – I mean, Noble couldn't play the first game, but he played the next three. I think he was a difference maker. He's like, you know, Brody's, you know, protege, Jason Noble, on the wing, and now they don't have Brody, so he's been playing there a lot better. You know, they have guys like Sanoski, who, if you watch Charlotte without Sanoski, the Charlotte's awful on defense. Just awful. Can't switch on picks. Can't roll over the top, can't get on anybody's hands. They look terrible because they don't have that second deep hole. Everyone else on that team is a third guy or a converted LSM. So they don't have a lot of good team defense. And what Sino brings is that good team defense. They're going to have Joe Moorer in pretty soon, from what I hear, maybe next game. And, you know, they have, you know, the hammer, Tucker Durkin, just throwing it down. He's actually gotten much better with his trail checks, which is interesting because he's kind of known as a guy that stands in front and just throws lumber, but he's gotten really, really good, like kind of hedging inside and throwing a nice trail check and getting the ball on the ground.
And before we go ahead and address one of the other elements of the early season that I want to discuss, that being the infusion of LXM players into the league for the first time this season, another kind of storyline that's developed is the diminished impact of the two-point shot in the early going of this season. You posted about it last week. I followed up with a little bit in terms of statistical analysis of you know, the incidence of two-point goals going in is down by about a half a goal per game. What's your take on this? How important is it, and how much do you attribute it to one of those kind of off-season interesting storylines, that being the fact that the MLL went away from a non-smooth ball, it's kind of nominally been called the grippy ball, because it has almost dimples similar to a golf ball on it, now back to a smooth ball that, you know, is pretty popular among the rest of lacrosse?
I think the difference you see just in games last year, even at the beginning, and people will attribute a lot of the, you know, downward slope to guys, you know, being on different teams and not adjusting to the 2-point line. I think the league by and large is much younger this year than it's been in a while. You had a lot of sophomore talent, a lot of, quote unquote junior talent coming in, third year guys trying to make the leap. And I think that the smooth ball or the regular ball, as you want to call it, you see it sail wide a lot more. And I've actually asked the coaches about it on the conference call. And, BJ O'Hara was like, yeah, I mean, I can definitely tell, especially from distance when they're shooting, the ball is sailing over the bar when it would go in last year. He's like, guys like, and he has big shooters. Like, he knows what he's talking about because he's an MLL coach, but he also has great shooters like Jeremy Sieverts, you know, Drew Snyder, Terry Kimmerer just dropping bombs. Those are guys that shoot very hard and are used to the grippy ball improving their accuracy a little bit. And I think that's definitely falling off. Is it a big deal? I mean, I'm not really know what I'm allowed to say here as far as what I think about whether or not it's a big deal as far as not the ball, but the press release. But I don't know. My whole,
let's avoid that topic because it's just, you know, number one, it's circumstantial. And number two, it's not really relevant to the impact on the field. I would say that there's pretty clear evidence to the fact that it is a big deal, not with respect necessarily to this being the only reason that they're struggling, but when you look at the fact that, you know, the Chesapeake Bayhawks are 1-3, you know, over the time that Dave Cottle has been in charge of that team, they have made no bones about the fact that the 2-point goal was a very important part of what they do. He's been, you know, quoted many times saying, well, if you shoot 20% from two, it's the same as shooting 40% from one. And they have 2 2-point goals on the season. You know, Mike Kimmel has one and, Steve Brooks has one. That means that Ben Hunt and Kyle Dixon do not. Kyle Dixon was a healthy scratch last week. You know, Ben Hunt has only played in 2 games so far this year. It's gotta be an element to their struggles if, you know, not a primary cause of it.
Well, Hunt is hurt. He got hurt in, I believe, not the Boston game, but the game afterwards. So I mean, that's why he's been out. But I mean, as far as they're just kind of a victim of their own setup, as far as that goes. Like, I mean, they knew they weren't getting the grippy ball and they probably thought it wasn't a big deal. And then they started shooting with it and they're like, wait a minute, what's going on here? So I was at the first game when they played Boston in the opener, and I watched, Dixon and Mundorf, and I don't think Brooks played in that game, but Hunt and a couple other guys come out and shoot, and they missed the net a lot, and they were taking twos from their spots, kind of like, you know, like NBA players come out and take 3-pointers. They're out there trying to hit that in stride. They're trying to catch and shoot it. They're trying to almost jump off the sweep and shoot, and the ball wasn't dropping. So, I mean, you could blame that on the grippy ball, or you could blame it on, well, maybe you shouldn't rely on the 2-point shot as much. I think it's probably a mixture of both. I think it stinks that like the best players in the world don't get to use the best ball in the world. Have you ever like thrown with a grippy ball?
Yeah, it's awesome. And it's awesome for like so many reasons. I mean, the primary one has less to do with anything like, you know, physical, meaning like something that you would learn about in physics class and why, you know, not having a smooth surface makes it fly straighter. And it has way more, in my opinion, to do with like, it doesn't get greasy. It doesn't have the same type of wear and tear on a field-turf field that a lot of other balls do.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know about that because from what I've been told from MLL equipment managers and GMs and stuff, they get new balls for every game. Supposedly for game balls. I mean, it's just like the NCAA. You can't play with old balls in the NCAA. You got to provide new balls for games, even at like the lowest D3 level. So I would think that they would do that for the MLL too.
I mean, that's fine. I guess I'm more referring to, that's my argument for why it should be completely widespread, why everybody should play with that ball. More, less so just why the MLL doesn't. You know what I mean? I think that, yeah, you know, there's been a lot of time and energy spent trying to figure out how to, I suppose, protect or preserve lacrosse balls for as long as you can, given this, you know, relative recent incidence of lacrosse balls dying very quickly, because of, you know, the rubber that they bounce off of when they hit the ground. And I've always felt like the grippy ball was a really good solution for that.
Well, can you go buy a grippy ball right now?
No, and that's part of the problem.
That is definitely the biggest part of the problem. But, you know, I think going forward, 2-point shot, no 2-point shot, you're still watching great games. And that's one of the things that, you know, one of the things I wrote in the column 2 weeks ago is that there have been tons of games decided by 1 or 2 goals. There's been 2 overtime games already. And that's awesome. Like, people are missing out because they're stuck in NCAA mode. And I'm looking forward to when, you know, I used to love championship weekend for NCAA. And now it's just like this annoying thing that stops the MLL season and like makes like no one jumps on to like game 5. So like as I've drifted more towards being like an MLL centric only person and just covering that, it's kind of, it annoys me.
that's not an opinion that's going to get you very many fans.
I don't care. That's my opinion. It annoys me because people should be watching great games no matter who's playing in them. And did I watch the NCAA games? Yeah, I watched the NCAA games. And I'm going to watch them this weekend. But I really wish more people paid attention to the MLL because attendance is down as well.
That's true. All right, well, Kyle, let's go ahead and bring in Ohio Machine midfielder Peter Baum. He is probably among the two most notable LXM to MLL compatriots, and I wanted to ask him about what his thoughts are on the league, what his thoughts are on the Machine. They're one of my favorite teams to watch in the league so far this season. And outside of that, I mean, he's just an interesting guy to talk to, talk about lacrosse with. So let's get him on the line. And the Inside Lacrosse MLL podcast continues with Ohio Machine midfielder and leading scorer for his team, Peter Baum, who is making his MLL debut after having been the number one pick in the draft 2 seasons ago and playing LXM. With the off-season partnership between LXM and MLL, he and a lot of his former LXM cohorts, teammates, opponents, etc., have now made their way into the league. And Pete, I think that, you know, there were some interesting questions leading into this season in terms of, you know, what was the level of play in LXM and how were some, you know, how are some of you guys going to perform? And certainly, when you look at the Machine scoring charts with you and Kyle there at the top, you know, it's obvious that's a pretty solid endorsement. But before we get to that, I'm just more interested in, you made some comments, you know, both last year, this year as well, just in terms of being really kind of intrigued by the competition level of MLL. So, you know, first things first, how has it met your expectations in that regard?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's been an exciting start to the year, obviously. We have a great group in Ohio, and they've been super welcoming of Kyle and myself and Eric Crum as well. So it's been a really nice group to be a part of. I think competition-wise, you know, it's what you expect from me. You know, I was particularly intrigued coming out of the Patriot League because I didn't play, you know, every week against, you know, guys that dominated the ACC for 4 years and stuff like that. So, you know, as you're out there looking around, and, you know, there's other great teams throughout the country as well, but the size and speed is certainly a little bit, a bit of an upgrade from the college game. So that's been exciting, you know, just trying to be out there and prove not only lacrosse wise, but athletically, you know, that I can hang. And I think it's gone well so far. So it's exciting.
Hey, Peter, it's Kyle. How you doing, man?
I'm good.
Good. You haven't played really a lot of any attack at all in the MLL so far.
Yep.
But who have you seen, you know, defensive midfield wise, LSM wise, that's covered you or that hasn't covered you yet, but you're looking forward to covering you that looks really like tough that you're into really just going against?
Yeah, I haven't played any attacks so far. I've been playing strictly midfield, but I have been getting the pull in every game this season, which is, you know, not, you know, as Kyle and I and Tommy go into the game, you know, Tommy Shriver is a line. Certainly any one of us could, you know, get the pull. It's not like we haven't seen the pull a lot in our careers. So that's, you know, comforting right there. But I think, you know, obviously Brody Merrill is someone that sticks out as kind of the guy in terms of the long stick midfield position who you grew up watching and so much admiration for him. And he's such a tremendous athlete, tremendous competitor. So I'm definitely excited to play against him. And then I think in this upcoming game against the Bayhawks, you know, in all likelihood, there'll be, you know, some switches and times when, Matt Abbott, I'll be matched up with him, and having played, you know, for him, he was the volunteer assistant at Colgate for 2 years, spent an awful lot of time on the road and stuff with him. So it'll be nice to be out there with him and kind of going back and forth. So I'm looking forward to that.
That will be a cool one. I remember at the beginning of last season, that was a matchup that was, slated to go down as well. So it'll finally come to fruition. Pete, you and I have talked like theoretical lacrosse a fair amount over the last couple, you know, years, and this is a really generic or basic question. I like watching the Machine play more than any other MLL team. Can you answer why? Like, what is it about your team that somebody like me would really enjoy watching? Do you think?
For one, I think we ride. You know, I think it's. So coaches and fans and people have been coming up to us talking about it throughout the year so far. It's something that I don't think you see a ton of in the MLL. I think over the years, you know, the guys are so good. It's very difficult to stop athletes like our league has on the ride. But, you know, with Eric Crum down there running around hitting people and Steele and Marcus doing a good job, I think we've done a good job of riding throughout the beginning of the year and causing some turnovers. So that's been exciting. I think, you know, speed and talent in the midfield, I think from a scoring perspective in particular, when you watch Kyle Tommy Shriver and myself line up out there. It's a pretty exciting group that, you know, certainly did a lot of good things in college lacrosse. You know, Tommy incredibly recently, obviously. But, yeah, you know, I think we play an exciting – we'd like to push the tempo a little more. I know, you know, Coach Davis, coming from Robert Morris and that up-tempo style, he would like us to push transition a little more. And, you know, we're not doing a good enough job of that yet. So that's something we're looking to work towards. But, you know, I think it's just a young group that kind of forgets each play and moves on to the next one. And that's been really exciting. And so I think, yeah, it's just a young group that's out there having fun.
P, you play for a franchise that does not have a storied history. And their biggest weakness in their 2 years of existence has been their offensive midfield. And now all of a sudden you and Kyle and Tom Schreiber come in and it's one of their strengths. And the team's playing definitely much better. And Terry's totally right. Cosmetically, the machine are very fun to watch on offense. What do you put that down to? Like, what do you think has made the impact? And do you think you guys are ready to turn the corner as like a playoff ready franchise?
Well, you know, I think if you look at the way our season has gone, the losses have been so close, and it's always tough to, you know, stomach a close loss. And I think we've realized that obviously the youth is good and bad. And in some spots down the stretch of games, I think the youth has cost us a little bit. Some of these teams have, you know, a lot of wily vets who just know how to close out games down the stretch. So that's something big that we need to keep improving on. And Kyle and Greg Bice are great leaders out there as veterans, and they've kind of keep helping us along in that regard. But, you know, I think, yeah, the offensive midfield, you know, as we came into the season, you know, Kyle and I were talking and various members of the team, we were like, all of a sudden, you know, this is a totally different team. When you bring in, you know, Kyle and I won the tour time, Tommy's going to be a 2-time finalist. You know, it's unbelievable. And so I think it's just a very revamped midfield. And then you add that to Steele Marcus and Logan Schiff down at attack. It's definitely a great group, and, you know, we're getting good goaltending right now. So we're close. You know, we're very close. I think there are some things we need to fix, but I think we're pretty close to turning that corner for sure.
It's an interesting thing, and I want to build on that answer, both the question and the answer, because they were both, you know, pretty interesting. I was thinking, and this is a little bit of a meandering question, so bear with me. I was listening to Reggie Bush on the Scott Van Pelt radio show on Wednesday, and he was talking about how the Detroit Lions fell apart a little bit in the second half of last season.
Yep.
And he made a comment about how NFL games are so frequently decided by a field goal or a touchdown margin. And I was thinking about it from the context of, like, there's a difference between being good enough to put yourself in a position to win, which you could say is why you kind of blew out the Hounds in the first game, versus knowing how to win, which maybe is part of the reason you lost the three subsequent games by no more than two goals. And as a guy who is, I don't know, I guess the easiest way to phrase the question is, where do you see yourself, you know, only, you know, 4 games into your MLL career, 2 years removed from college, but obviously, you know, shouldering a pretty big burden in terms of production, as well as being surrounded by guys who don't have a whole lot more experience than you do in terms of being somebody who's going to be a part of helping this team learn how to win?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think it's interesting, you know, as I look back on my career, there are certainly people that have won more than I have. You know, I'm not, you know, standing there saying I went to 4 Final Fours and won national championships and stuff like that, like some of these guys have. Kyle's been, you know, he's been a great mentor to me over the, you know, the last year or so, and he has done it at the highest level and won at the highest level, and Steele has as well. So offensively, you know, that's a group that, you know, really is able to lead by example and get us in the right spots. For me personally, at the end of games, you know, I like to rely on my athleticism, and that's what's kind of always gotten me through. I always feel like my legs can bail me out. And so that's what I like to do late in games, is just, you know, stick to whatever the play is that we're going to run and try and run it. But two of those games, we've, you know, been in a situation where we needed a 2-point goal with 20 seconds left, and that's certainly a tough ask with the goaltenders in this league. So, frankly, we just need to do a better job. You know, the Florida game, we had a good chance down by one, and, you know, Brett Queener makes a good save on me, and, you know, I can live with that. But the other ones, we need to do a better job getting into a 1-goal game with 1 possession to go and give ourselves a little bit better look. But, you know, just some mental lapses, and so I keep learning in this league. You know, I'd certainly like for my team to trust me, you know, in clutch time, and, you know, I think everybody feels that way. And so, but yeah, we certainly need to keep it closer than two. It's got to be a 1-goal game with 1 possession to go for sure.
Let's talk about the Denver game. I know you probably don't want to. you guys were amazing for, I would say, out of the, 45 minutes you play on the clock, you were amazing for at least half an hour of it. Then what happened? What was the turning point in that game for you guys? Like what kind of allowed that comeback? Cause you were up by four at one point and you were battling back and forth, and then they just kind of pulled away and got over the top on you.
Yeah. I mean, it's, we didn't start great in that game. We got down big early, came right back, took the lead. Jeremy Siebert hits a two to tie it, and then we build the four goal lead. So we were really proud of that game looking back. You know, that Jeremy Siebert's goal could have been a backbreaker because we had a two goal lead and they tied it up. Instead, we go on a big run, go up four, and then we have, they just grinded us out in the fourth quarter. They're such a veteran team and they have so many good players. And I think at the faceoff X, they really wore us down defensively. In the midfield, I think we just got tired. You know, it's tough to do out there. And I think we got tired and they won faceoffs and strung some possessions together. And, that's the way it goes. You know, they just wore us down. And eventually, I think it's just it got to a two goal game and we couldn't get in there, but it's tough. You play a team like that that's won, I don't know what it is now, 25 regular season games in a row or something like that. It's definitely impressive. And you could kind of feel that, they had a lot of confidence even when they were down and, we were trying to hang on. And, I think we need to stay a little more aggressive late in games and keep pumping the ball in the back of the net. And we just weren't able to do that.
Pete, hashtag oil up.
Yeah.
What does that mean?
I don't know. Well, it's oiling the machine.
Yes, so, that I get. But I meant,
oil in it, otherwise it won't work smoothly. So you're oiling up.
In essence.
What it means, it's just kind of something we say to get fired up. I think it's one of those things that you kind of realize it sounds funny, and when you write it, you're like, I don't really like the way that sounds, but it's our thing, and so we embrace it, and we kind of know that when we say it, other people think it's funny, and so it sort of brings the team together, and it's one of those things that, it's fun to have something that you can bond over and laugh about as a team, especially in this league where we don't spend as much time together as we would like to. So it's kind of fun, but it's definitely getting some play in the social media game, I think.
I'm all about it.
You're all about it?
Absolutely.
That's good.
Favorite hashtag in lacrosse, for sure. Easy.
There aren't that many consistent ones in lacrosse.
Yes, I will say that it stands among a relatively small group of peers. But I mean, I think it's perfect. I think that not only is it, not only does it make sense, but it also speaks to what I think is, you hit the nail on the head, by the way, in terms of what it is about your team that I like watching. I mean, the ride is for sure part of it. But I think the other part of it is reflected in that hashtag. It's the fact that there are, a dozen or so guys who are young enough to be active on social media, to be funny, and to not take themselves too seriously. And I think that the way that manifests itself in a hashtag or your play on the field, it's definitely one of the things about, an MLL team that represents a place that's pretty close to where I'm from and what I understand needs to happen in order for a team to be successful there. It goes a long way. And I think the fact that you guys seem to like each other is hugely beneficial for the sustainability of this team.
Sure. I mean, that's a big part of it. I think we have very few egos on this team and just a lot of guys that come from good programs and like playing lacrosse and like having fun together. And, from the celebrations and stuff like that, I know for us, we like to get excited after goals. It's funny to play. Some teams, I love the way Boston seems to get excited after they score. Some of the other teams haven't as much. Denver certainly did. I think it's great. I think, it's good to see guys having fun and taking it seriously, and that's what I wanted from the league, and that's what our team is definitely about, just playing loose, having a good time, and working hard. It's been fun so far, definitely.
Why does Logan Schuss have an American flag on the back of his helmet? He does. I saw it the other day.
You'd have to check if Kyle Matisse does too, because I'm not sure if we have the option. Maybe we don't have the little Canadian flags. Maybe we need to get on that.
That's tough.
Surprised he hasn't noticed.
With Worlds coming up, that's got to be controversial.
I know. Yeah, it's tough. So I'll have to let him know. I bet you. You know what? I bet you he doesn't even know. you kind of just get the helmet and you put it on, and then you make sure it fits. And I didn't even know we had flags on the back of our helmets, so there you go.
All right.
Right on. Breaking news from Pete Baum. Logan Schuss about to make an acquisition of a Canadian flag sticker.
Canadian flag. It's going to be a blockbuster deal.
Right on, right on. Well, Pete, thanks so much for your time, man. Enjoy. We appreciate you jumping on the podcast call early out there on the West Coast. Enjoy your coffee and week off, and we look forward to checking you out next week, man.
Sounds good. Thank you. Have fun. Have fun at Final Four weekend.
And the Inside Lacrosse MLL podcast continues with Denver Outlaw attackman Eric Law, who's got 12 goals and 6 assists to lead the Outlaws in scoring through their first 4 games. And Eric, I think, you know, as fans get caught up on this MLL season, there's a dichotomy to the way in which they should approach the start that your Outlaw team is off to. The first is that the Outlaws being undefeated or at, you know, top of the standings is not an uncommon place to have found them over the recent history of the league. But on the flip side of that, your team without Brennan Mundorf and a couple other really significant contributors, that, you know, reinvention has been a part of this franchise's mold, successful reinvention as well, you know, kind of continuously. And I'm interested in your thoughts on how you fit into that. When you look around your locker room, when you see this team, is there any aspect of the 4-0 start that surprises you?
Not necessarily, but also, I mean, to win games in ML, it's never an easy thing to do. So, anytime that you can get, off to a good start like we have, I think it's really important, especially I feel like at least what I've been told from the veterans on our team, like Jesse Schwartzman and Anthony Kelly and a bunch of these guys and Lee Zing telling us that, you know, these first couple weeks are so important to get off into a good start, just because that's when kind of teams are still kind of figuring out who they are, who they're going to be. And then especially once the college kids kind of come into the lineup, a lot of teams add a lot of talent to their rosters. And so it's so important to get off into a good start to kind of put yourself out really in front of teams that you can kind of go into the season and keep going further with having those wins on your belt is definitely a huge plus. So anytime that you can win, I think it's a huge thing. And I think with our locker room, it's just a lot of the same key guys. I mean, you mentioned guys like Mundorf left, which was definitely a huge move for our team in the off season. But I really feel like everyone's kind of still just kind of bought into the system and make sure that it's not just all about one or two guys. It's really about playing really unselfish ball. And I feel like if you watch us play, we really try to settle for dunks and layups instead of kind of dropping the outside shot, and luckily I'm the beneficiary of a lot of those. So just the way that we play, I feel like kind of lets me be more productive and everything. So I think that absolutely helps. Having teammates like we have definitely helps out.
You mentioned playing with Mundorf last year. This year you've played with Junior a couple times. Obviously they're very different players, but two players that are basically two of the best players to play the position, at least in the MLL, if not the entire sport. How has that kind of helped you develop, and what's your experience been with that?
I can't thank Brennan Mundorf enough for the way that he kind of helped me come into this league last year, kind of teaching me the ropes as soon as I got there. You know, just giving you kind of the ins and outs of how to play the game at this level. And I can't thank enough Junior for what he's done. It's just been a joy to be able to play with him. I mean, he's, like you said, arguably one of the best players to ever play the game. So it's pretty fun just to be able to get back there, and it's pretty crazy. I never thought that I'd be in a position playing attack with Brent or John Grant Jr. So it's definitely an honor to be able to play alongside him. And it's just, I think, an adjustment each week, just trying to learn how each one of us wants to play and just kind of reading him and what situations and where he wants me to be on different spots of the field.
Eric, kind of continuing with this theme of the way in which fans that haven't seen the Outlaws play so far this season should expect a little bit of a different look, whether it be from, you know, your style personally or your offensive style. I mean, obviously there's some continuity when you've got, you know, Jeremy Sievers going down the alley and, you know, a guy, Andrew Snyder, who I contend is among the most versatile offensive midfielders in pro lacrosse. But the transition from Brendan, who was among the more traditional lefty incisive Dodgers, a guy that could get to the goal with speed and movement very easily, in comparison to Junior, who I think at this point now plays more of a back-end game, and then obviously with Bocklet still roaming around the interior. What has been the ask for you in terms of the way that you maybe have modified what you do this year compared to last year?
I think that they just asked me to kind of carry the ball more and kind of be, I don't necessarily say the quarterback, but just kind of the guy that kind of is reading the situation. And I think it's I love it because they allow me to kind of be the guy that either is carrying the ball and kind of down to the goal, and also kind of be the guy that just works off ball and try to get open for other people. So it definitely, I really think that me, Chris, and Junior really complement each other as well. All of our playing styles really actually go hand in hand with the other people. So like you said, Junior's kind of a back down guy. Chris is definitely an off ball guy, but can also beat his guy when he has to. And he's been, put a short stick on him. He's been able to beat his guy numerous of times already this year, which is a huge advantage. And just, I really just kind of play the role of kind of doing a little bit of both.
The best play I've seen all year, maybe not the best goal, but the best play I've ever seen all year, is it involves you and Drew Snyder sealing, throwing the dagger in Ohio's back, with the Drew Snyder falling out of bounds, tossing it up, and you just dunking it home on an empty net. How did that play develop? It just looked totally spontaneous and amazing.
It was definitely spontaneous. I think there was like less than a minute left in the game. We got the ball down. The shot clock was kind of running low, and I actually started with it, and they double teamed me in the corner. And I can't remember which shorty got open, but I just kind of rolled it to him in the corner. And actually, as he was falling out, he rolled it over to Drew. And Drew made an unbelievable play with two pulls, draped all over him, picked the ball up as he was jumping out of bounds, kind of just threw it in front of the net. And luckily, I just noticed as soon as I got double-teamed, all the guys' attention kind of went to the guy with the ball. So I literally just cut to the net, and Drew made an unbelievable play to put it right in front of the net. And I was able just to kind of bury it home. And that was kind of the dagger that kind of went into Ohio, because that put us up by two with about 15 seconds left. And they were able to get a two-point look at the end of the game, but Jesse was able to make a great save. But it was an unbelievable play by Drew Schneider all around.
Eric, it would be remiss to not ask you about your former teammates who are in the Final Four this weekend, and certainly I would imagine you've got some colors flying pretty high for the Pios. What are your thoughts on just kind of the way in which a similar type of situation has occurred at in Coach Brown's offense this season, as you could make an argument happen to the Outlaws, and that is, you graduate after kind of coming in, going from I don't want to undersell it, but kind of a third attackman with Demopoulos being the main quarterback and Matthews being the finisher. Last year, you really emerged as an excellent quarterback in your own right. And now to see Jack Bobbsey and kind of do a similar thing, in terms of production, wearing your number, transfer, the whole nine yards. It's just crazy. What are your thoughts just on how, impressive it is for this Denver program to make this run to the Final Four?
I think the most impressive part with this DU team is just how young they are. I remember talking with a couple guys from the team from a couple years ago, and everyone that's pretty much producing is either a sophomore, a freshman, or junior. And it's just scary to think about how scary good this team actually can be. But I just think that it just goes to show how good of a coach Coach Brown is and his system, and how he really gets everyone on the team to really buy in. And I think that's the whole reason why DU's offense has been so successful, is everyone really buys into his systems and kind of his philosophy of offense. And I think it just goes to show that guys with like good fundamentals can definitely step up and play those roles. And Jack's done an unbelievable job of coming in already in his first year and being an excellent quarterback already. But the other thing that really scares me about this DU team is all six guys on offense, and even their second midline, they all have the ability to go off in a game. There's not one guy that you can just be like, all right, we think that he might just have one goal. All the guys have the ability to go off for three, four, or five goals, and they all can do it in every single way. Every single guy on that team can beat you one-on-one, and every one of them can beat you from playing the crease. So there's no set crease guy in Coach Brown's offense. It's just kind of everyone does everything. There's no one go-to guy, which actually in the end kind of hurts Denver players-wise getting the accolades that I'm biased, but I feel like they deserve at least. But I just feel like it's just a system that they play, and I can't wait to watch this game because it's going to be two great offenses and two great head coaches going against each other.
Eric, last one from me. Obviously, Denver has the Outlaws have a great history. In the regular season, you guys have the 24-game regular season unbeaten win streak going right now. But, you know, it has to sit in the back of the mind. I know it sits in the back of my mind because I cover the league so much. It's been hard to buy in to the Outlaws as of late. And last year I did. And, obviously it didn't turn out for you guys. I guess convince me and any of the other doubters why this team is better and why that we should think you guys are going to win this year in championship weekend. I feel like we already know you're going to be there. You're kind of like been a mainstay and I know it's far off, but like convince me why it's different, why the team is better and this might be your year.
That's a tough one. Put me on the spot with that one, but you know, I honestly don't know if there's any way I can convince you rather than just going out there and playing. I mean, it's tough to get anyone convinced because it's definitely been that spot where the Outlaws always get there and then they can never bring it home. So I don't know if we can really convince anyone until we actually come through and actually do what we've been hoping to do for the past so many years is finally bring home that trophy. But I feel like this team just has such a good mix of all different kinds of players. We have unbelievable veteran leadership. We got some young guys that are definitely coming in. We have a lot of American type style players. We also have a good mix of Canadians. I just think that we have a very well-rounded team that with good veteran leadership and with the spunk of some of these young guys that are coming in that can give us a lot of energy. We're hoping that this is the year, but I don't know if we can convince anyone else or ourselves, but just going out and playing hard every single game and fighting to the last quarter.
I love that answer. That's a perfect answer. Because, like, it's not – well, first of all, no team and this isn't to discredit the question, Kyle, because I certainly understand why you ask it, but it's like no team right now is good enough to win an MLL championship. It's all about getting better. It's all about like playing your best on championship weekend, having the breaks go your way. And the other thing that's a real unknown, in my opinion, is just a new format could potentially change all the juju. So we'll just have to see what happens, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Right on. Well, Eric Law, we really appreciate your time, man. Enjoy yourself this weekend as you watch the alma mater in Baltimore for the Final Four. Hopefully you get an opportunity to put your feet up, rest, stay healthy, and look forward to seeing you as you continue on this run with the Outlaws.
All right, thanks, guys. Appreciate it.
So what do you think, Kyle?
About what?
About his answer. About the fact that you can't convince fans, you can't convince media, can't convince anybody of anything that you're not. And right now, they're not a MLL championship team. They haven't shown it to us. So the only answer is we got to show it to you when we have the opportunity. And in the meantime, they just are going to continue to do what they do, I feel like.
It's like, I know Denver is the favorite to win every game, and I know that they should be, like, mentioned in the conversation as one of the best teams, but it's like, does it matter if you can't do it in the playoffs? Like, it's starting to, like, really weigh. I know it weighs on the fans, because, I mean, after they lost, you should have seen the Twitter feed. It was, like, it last year.
Are you talking about Outlaw fans specifically, or are you talking about MLL fans generally?
No, Outlaw fans specifically are just like, I can't believe this. Like, can't believe it happened again. I'm talking like hardcore long time ones. And I don't think it's the unrest that you see when like, you know, other teams from like hotbed areas lose in the playoffs or anything like that. But the history of success versus this one game of failure every single year since the franchise has existed, like that is that harder than being bad the whole time?
No, it is absolutely not.
I don't know, because I'm a Boston fan, so I don't know what that's like. But,
well, if you can put yourself into the mind space that you experienced in 2000, you probably would understand very easily what it's like.
Sure.
And this has been my attitude, and it's formed by, you know, being a Cleveland sports fan growing up. And I think that the value of being continually competitive, it really depends on what you want to get out of being a sports fan. And for me, I want to be entertained. I want to have the diversion. I want to be able to watch something that has me excited as deep into the season as possible. So if you gave me the opportunity to be a Florida Marlins fan or a Cleveland Indians fan during the period of time from 1993 to 2003, in which the Florida Marlins had like two or three winning seasons but won two World Series versus the Indians, who had like eight winning seasons and lost in two World Series, I would choose to be an Indians fan, because there were so many of those seasons in which I got 5 months of enjoyment out of. And I would rather have that than, you know, 20% of a decade actually keeping me interested. Because the other thing that happens to those types of teams, when you win unexpectedly, I don't think it's as easy to savor, because you weren't invested from the beginning. You didn't think that, it took you a while to start to think that it was a realistic possibility. And so you missed out on a little bit of that run. And I think that, you know, for Outlaw fans, when they do eventually win, and if you're good long enough, I mean, it's really rare that you don't eventually get over the hump, it will be satisfying. And I think that at that point, and this is, again, just a very personal perspective on what it means to be a sports fan, but I think at that point, you realize that winning a championship is a very, like, minor moment in time. And the feeling passes, and then you start thinking about the next season. And, yeah, you want your team to win a championship the next season, but you realize that there, in this league, are seven other fan bases that want their team to win a championship. So the odds are not really in your favor, and you got to enjoy the process of trying to get there. It's the same thing as an athlete. An athlete and a coach has to enjoy the process, and I think that, you know, fans kind of do as well. You got to realize that if you're leaving the stadium satisfied, you know, a disproportionate amount of the time, if you're an Outlaws fan, it's been like 23 games in a row, then there's a lot of value in that.
I have one counter. Only one. Do you know what it is?
It's probably going to be something stupid about being a Patriots fan or something like that.
Absolutely not. Actually, the opposite end. 90s Buffalo Bills fans would disagree with everything you just said.
Would they, though? Would you have rather been a Buffalo Bills fan from 91 to 95 or a Buffalo Bills fan from 2001 to 2005?
I mean, that's not what we're talking about.
Yeah, it is.
That's what you made the question into. That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying...
All right, fine, but the only reason I made the question into that is because we had already answered the previous question, which is that, yeah, they've lost in the semifinals every year in their existence, and it's frustrating, and you have
they
to accept that, and that's fine. Or whatever. I mean, they lost in championship weekend.
8 years. 8 years.
Yeah,
I mean,
I understand.
They've been the best team of those 8 years, probably six of those 8 years. Like, record-wise.
And there have been some extremely bizarre circumstances throughout that period of time.
Any other team, more individual accolades, more leading scorers, MVPs, goalie awards, coaches awards. It goes up, it goes all the way to the top. And at some point there has to be like, I mean, obviously Mundorf is like them going like, all right, well, we're going to try something else. You know, I think that's when people talk about the Mundorf trade, they like don't really look at that aspect of it.
But it's not just that. It's not just that. They've done that pretty much every single year. Like if you were to go back and trace the continuity of 1 year to the next in terms of the Denver Outlaws, like maybe in that period of time, where they had, you know, Sebald, Langtry, Westy, and Mundorf in like the 2011 or 2010 to 11 range, somewhere in there. That's the only time that they really tried the same thing multiple years in a row. But like, you know, first this was a Sim Sankey team, and then it was like, you know, kind of a Matt Brown, Drew Westervelt team as well. And that's not true. Mundorf was in the mix there as well. And I mean, they've just had so many different incarnations of what they've been offensively, and to a different degree defensively. I mean, obviously Schwartzman's been there, you know, as a bona fide starter for what, 8 years, 7 years. So it's not as if, like, you know, there haven't been some elements of continuity, and Eric spoke to that as well. Lee Zink, obviously. But yeah, I mean, they've had a litany of coaches, a litany of GMs, that have gone on and, you know, found success or failure elsewhere. I don't think their struggles have been for lack of trying something different. If anything, it's probably an easier case to make that they weren't consistent enough. I mean, I know that it sounds crazy because they are among the most consistent franchises in all of MLL that, you know, not just like all of MLL history of the 14 years and all of the franchises, they are probably among the most consistent, or probably the most consistent.
They are the most consistent.
But yet they've still had this crazy amount of reinvention year to year.
No, that's normal attrition. I don't put that up to crazy amount of reinvention.
No, it was total reinvention. And I'm not saying that it wasn't a product of attrition, but like, just think about like that to go from a Sim Sankey team to a Mundorf Westerveld team was a dramatic departure.
Yeah, but how many times did that happen? That happens, that shift from like midfield heavy to attack heavy to like different kind of like philosophy. That happens every year with every team. And the thing that changes is the coach and not necessarily the organization. The players, you know, the best thing about the MLL and the growth of the MLL is shown more recently because the players matter less. It's more like a regular professional sports team, sports league in the last couple years, especially the last 2-3 years, because while you need great players to win, the coaches that have not been good have not won and have had not just limited success, but no success. And that's the thing that I think has changed as the league has grown, is that the coaches and the philosophy and the assistant coaches, the Bayhawks don't just win because of Cottle. Do you know what I mean? They win because of Tony Resch too. That's what you need to win too. That you need to have more attention on your back room in your taking care of the players even than you do acquiring the players. Do you know what I mean? Like the talent doesn't get you wins. That's not good enough anymore. Having the star player that scores 50 points a season, you know, 75 points a season does not guarantee you a championship. And I feel like it did in the beginning. I really feel like it did. Like if you looked at the allocation of the players early on, you know, you had the Gates and Casey Powell on Long Island. Gee, I wonder if they're going to win some championships. You know, you had,
Mikey Gary and Maracek on Baltimore, yeah, in 2005.
I mean, but the league is so different now. It's so much better. And the youth and the athleticism is so much more important. It's the MLL is like a microcosm of all sports right now. Like jammed into a blender and like spun up. And now, oh, what's more important in sports now? What do scouts look for? You know, in any sport, athleticism is like number one. And then like, oh, I can teach them skill is like the way that a lot of modern coaches think. And I think that is bearing out in the MLL right now with varying degrees of success. And Denver is really good because they have that consistent base. They have a lot of youth and they have a ton of athleticism at the most important positions. And I want to talk about Denver because I don't want to be fooled again. Do you know what I mean? Like that's like a personal thing for me. Like I backed that team to the hilt. I wrote like at least two columns and like 5,000 words on how good they were. And they were, and they still are. There's like pieces that still are. And even though Mundorf's gone, like you can see that the team runs very similarly. But like when does that ceiling hit of like, oh my God, how come we can't win the big game? And that's like, that intrigues me. Like that's like I know it's probably not a big storyline for everyone else, but like, that like really hits home. Like I really want to examine that. I want to look at that as the season goes on. Cause sometimes like they win games just cause they're better.
What if there is no rational answer? Sports is oftentimes a function of many things that don't really, consistency doesn't always win. Consistency wins most consistently, but that's the part. And like, that's why athletes put so much emphasis on preparation rather than performance, because they understand that there are a lot of variables that go into performance that are out of their control. And one of the things that isn't out of their control is how they prepare. And I feel like you hear people talk about that all the time. You know, Brendan Mundorf breaking his ankle in, you know, pregame warmups is not something that you can prepare for. And, you know, Anthony Kelly having a bad day against Jeff Snyder is an aspect of performance that you can't necessarily prepare for. Like, he's had good days against Jeff Snyder. It's not, you know, teams lose games for all sorts of different reasons. It really comes down to making a choice about what do you believe. Is there a particular reason that it seems so consistent to happen that the Outlaws lose games on championship weekend that they would have won during the regular season? Is it a hurricane? You know what I mean? Like, the number of bizarre things that have prevented this team from winning is staggering. Or is there something more to it? And it's just a personal choice. You just have to.
Right.
And that's, I think, what you're probably going to spend the summer trying to decide, right?
Yeah. And I mean, we've had this conversation before where, like, I'm so jealous that you get to write and do things, you know, with the magazine and the website all day, because you don't have to, like, lose. You don't lose. Do you know what I mean? Like we've had this conversation. I feel like you had this, like, glazed over look in your eye. Like, what the heck are you talking about, dude? But, like, the winning is, like, the best thing. You know, people say, like, scoring goals is great and, you know, all that stuff. But, like, winning on a consistent basis and then losing, like, what's that like? Like, how can you imagine that? Like, I can't even imagine that, like, level of sledgehammer to the heart that, like, all those players have taken. Do you know what I mean? I mean, if we get Kyle Harrison, I'm going to ask him about that, too, because he was on that 2009 team that lost to the Nationals. You know, that was like, and that's one of the best MLO finals I've ever seen. I mean, obviously, aside from, you know, the overtime games early on in the aughts, as they call it. Like that level of total excellence for 12, 14, you know, however many games. And then, like, that one shattering, oh my God, I can't believe you made that play. Like that fascinates me to, like, no end. To no end, to, like, know what, like, I mean, I don't know at that level what it's like to lose and win, but, like, the best thing about covering the league is, like, you see that, like, all these guys just want to, like, win. Like, I love that. And I don't think it gets enough dap from anybody. And I think that that's one of the other things that we were talking about, as other professional leagues, like, you see a lot of guys playing for their stats and stuff like that. And there are guys in the MLL that play for stats. I'm not stupid. I know that. But, by and large, as a whole, the MLO is still, like, a very pure, like, level of competition where, like, winning matters the most. You know, winning matters, and winning during the season, winning every game, winning the championship matters the most.
Was it 2011? Was that the one at Navy Marine Corps that was played in the rainstorm?
The one I flew through a hurricane for? Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So, and that they lost that game 11-9 to Hamilton. Casey Powell played. Did Hamilton go on to win the championship?
No, they lost.
They lost. They lost to the Bayhawks.
No, they lost to Boston in 2011.
Oh, okay. That was knee to knee. Casey Powell's injury, right? Was
yes.
At the end of that game. Okay. I remember Brian Langtree and Jarrett Park like after that game, and like the palpable pain at losing. It was bizarre. Not bizarre in a way that it should have been unexpected, but bizarre in a way that it was like, this is very real. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. Like, it means something.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that's, you know, that's the best thing. And I mean, obviously I bang this drum and I'm the guy that everyone hates because the players hate me and the players like me. And I don't care about that. Like, at the end of the day, like, people should want, like, I just want people to watch. You know what I mean? I want people to, like, experience the league because I really do think that the best players in the world play in the MLL.
Right.
And if you love lacrosse, how can you not love the highest level of lacrosse when every other sport you watch, you love the highest level of that? It makes no sense to me. You're American. That's what we love. That's why we don't like soccer. We don't watch the best soccer. You know what I mean? Like, I wish I could just, like, shake people and be like, watch MLL. Why? You know, but, you know, after NCAAs are over, I don't think I'll have to. I think if people tune into a game, they'll see a great game no matter what, because all these teams are good. I mean, not good, but, like, all these teams are entertaining. Every team has a player that you can watch and latch onto and be like, that's my guy. Like, that guy's awesome. That guy's nasty. I can't wait to see him play.
That seems like a really good place to leave off on.
Right on.
Kyle Devitt, first 2014 MLL podcast is in the books. Thanks a lot for your time, man. Thanks to Eric Law. Thanks to Peter Baum. And we will catch you probably next week.
Sounds good. Thanks.
Inside Lacrosse Podcast.